Welcome to The Other Hand, a podcast brought to you by CJP Economics, a collaboration between Jim Power and Chris Johns, where we discuss the intersection between politics, finance, and economics. Our back catalogue of podcasts can be found at our Substack website, and that Substack site also contains our extensive body of written work. Thanks for listening and reading. If you like our work, please share with your friends and sign up to our newsletter. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Other Hand. It's my great pleasure to welcome once again my guest, Duncan Weldon. This is the third time Duncan has made a guest appearance on the podcast. The first time we discussed his marvelous recent book, 200 Years of Muddling Through, a fabulous read on economic history of Great Britain. Thoroughly recommend that to everyone. Growing out of that, he's agreed to stand in for Jim during the last couple of weeks. So many thanks to Duncan. A big recommendation for his book. That's the quid pro quo that all I can offer him for coming on the pod. But good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me back again. Clearly didn't go too badly last week.
No, the numbers and feedback has been great. So it's been fantastic. I hope you've got similar feedback. The agenda for today, as always, is pretty open. There's lots going on. The thing that I would like to start with is talking about global inflation and issues around that. And if we have time, to have a few words with you, given your background as an economist at the Bank of England, a journalist with august institutions like Newsnight and other publications like The Economist, your insight into the UK budget, I think our listeners would be really interested in. But can we start with inflation? Because something that you wrote recently on your own Substack site, because like me, you have a Substack website, like all the best journalists these days, we have our own Substack site. And again, I can thoroughly recommend Duncan's, and please sign up to it if you can. You quoted Charles Goodhart, another member of the great and the good of the British economic establishment over many decades, as saying quite recently that the economics profession has no general theory of inflation. Now, in and of itself, I find that quote quite remarkable, actually. After all these, dare I say, centuries of theoretical work, empirical work, on the bookshelves behind me, they groan with books that are entirely about inflation. Most of them have chapters on inflation. I have Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz's thing that is causing my shelf to bend, A Monetary History of the United States, which is all about a particular theory of inflation backed up by thousands of pages of evidence. And for an economist to say today or recently that we have no general theory of inflation, I think speaks to or asks the question, was all of that effort in vain? Why do we still not have a general theory of inflation? And it's, of course, particularly relevant today because there is a global inflation problem. And I want to talk about that as well. So I want to talk about the theory and the state of the economics profession generally, and then about this specific problem that we all face as individuals and as economies, countries. It was a big part of yesterday's budget, for example, whether or not inflation would hit 4 or 5% over the next while in the UK. And many countries are having that debate. The big debate is whether or not it's transitory or not, to use that word. But can we start with that Goodhart quote, "Economists don't have a general theory of inflation," and why you began your piece with that quote?
Yeah, of course. So this was Charles Goodhart, who's, you know, former chief economist of the Bank of England, professor at the London School of Economics, you know, very esteemed senior member of the profession and a former policymaker, speaking at Sintra in Portugal, which is the European Central Bank's annual sort of get together of the great and the good in monetary economics. And, you know, he sort of shocked the conference, as it were, by saying we have no general theory of inflation. And he was very interesting. He sort of laid out how we got here at the state of macroeconomics, that, you know, if you go back three or four decades, there were sort of two competing theories of inflation. You had this Keynesian theory, sort of based around what was called a Phillips curve relationship, which postulated that, you know, inflation was determined by essentially the level of unemployment, that if unemployment went very low, firms would be competing for workers, wages would get pushed up, that would feed through into general prices. And this sort of Keynesian theory was based on state of demand in the economy, how low unemployment was. Empirically, that relationship has broken down over the last few decades. Then along comes the book that makes your bookshelf groan, Schwartz and Friedman's Monetary History of the United States. And we had this monetary theory of inflation, that inflation is everywhere, you know, a phenomenon of too much money chasing too much goods. And if you control the supply of money, you'll keep inflation low and stable. But then that theory has empirically broken down as well. So for the last sort of 20, 30 years, sort of the working theory, certainly in central bank land, is something that Charles Goodhart called a bootstrap theory. This idea that what determines inflation is expectations of inflation. And if firms, workers, financial markets expect inflation to be stable, then inflation will be stable because they will set prices and wages and contracts and loans on the basis of stable, or in the jargon, anchored expectations. And that's sort of been the working theory in central bank land, that what you've got to do is keep medium-term inflation expectations stable and the rest will look after itself. But Charles Goodhart thinks sort of the theoretical basis for this has always been weak. The empirical basis has never been as strong as people think it is. And he's not the first person saying this. The very end of September, Jeremy Rudd, who's a senior economist at the US Federal Reserve, in fact, in charge of inflation forecasting at the Federal Reserve, wrote really quite a strongly worded paper saying, look, the theoretical basis of our theory of inflation doesn't really work. And I'm not sure the empirical evidence is there either, which is what takes you back to Charles Goodhart, sort of saying the biggest debate in global macroeconomics and macroeconomic policy at the moment, certainly the advanced economies, is this period of high inflation going to be transitory, or is it a shift to structurally higher inflation? And what you've got senior members of the profession saying is, we don't really have a way to go about answering that question, which is not ideal.
Do you think it's true? One of the things that strikes me about this is that it's not, in terms of economics, it's not just about inflation. One of my favorite, also a Substack writer these days, a blogger of many years past, is a guy called Noah Smith, who seems to write an annual article about the state of economics. And one phrase that struck me in a recent piece by him, and it speaks to something you were saying about causal relationships, is that macroeconomics, the reason why macro in many ways is so difficult, if not impossible, is because we never really, at the end of the day, can sort out what causes what. We can postulate, we can hypothesize, we can have a look at, and we can test, but we, in many ways, simply don't have the necessary data to sort out the causality question, which is why these macro questions about inflation and lots of other things, because we might ask the same, you know, do we have a general theory that is accepted by everyone of unemployment? I suspect we probably don't. All the macro phenomena that we look at, the reason why we can't forecast the economy is that our tools, the toolkit that we have available to us, just isn't up to scratch. And that's not an individual moral failure on the part of economists. It's just that we're perhaps physics at the time of Copernicus, that or perhaps we will always be physics at the time of Copernicus, because unlike the physicists, we will never have access to proper data. We seem to have decent tools, and this is one of the criticisms, of course, that many popular critiques of economists make, is that our tools are fancy. If you look at the work of the recent Nobel Prize winners in economics, a lot of quite ordinary lay people would actually understand what it is that they're trying to do, although perhaps the tools that they're using might be beyond those that don't have a reasonably advanced education in mathematics. But if you were to look at something like, dare I say, a dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model, you'd stand no chance of being an intelligent layperson about understanding, because the tools and techniques that we do have to actually analyze the data that we do, such as it is, are pretty good. Is it the data or is it the tools or is there something more fundamentally wrong, do you think, Duncan?
I think it's a bit of both, I think, to be honest. I think firstly on the data, I mean, you know, if anything, we have too much data. And, you know, what we, one of the really big things of 2020 was, you know, it must have been the most analyzed and tracked recession of all time. So, you know, we used to, you know, once upon a time, you used to have to wait for national statistics officers to give you, you know, unemployment figures and inflation figures and growth figures. And for the last 18 months, we've had, you know, real-time tracking of mobility from Apple and Google data. We've had live restaurant bookings from OpenTable. People monitoring traffic cams to work out, you know, traffic levels. You know, we've had so much real-time tracking. But the problem is, you've got all of this data. And I think, you know, what you were saying is right, that there's so much going on in a modern macroeconomy that isolating cause and effect is very, very difficult. So, you know, we have these policy tools and we can debate what we think they do, but it's going to be very hard to ever precisely say, you know, doing X caused Y. And then you're right, you move on to the, you know, the attempts to model this and forecast this. And, you know, forecasting is very hard. Be absolutely clear, forecasting is very hard, particularly economic shocks happen quite regularly, whether that's surging gas prices at the moment or supply chain crunches, which blow you off course. And I think one problem with lots of the kind of modeling that central banks prefer to work with, you know, these dynamic general stochastic equilibrium models, all of this sort of stuff, or even some of the mental models that fiscal policymakers are working with. In the medium term, the assumption is pretty much always the economy returns to what they call trend growth. Problem is, trend growth is really, really hard to estimate. You know, you can have a reasonably accurate picture on a sort of 4 or 5 year view of how many workers are going to be available, what the population is going to grow like. Now, obviously, migration patterns can change that, but you can be reasonably certain. But apart from that, you know, forecasting medium-term productivity, forecasting how much firms are going to invest, it's just very, very hard. And if you've got a model which assumes you return to trend growth, but you don't really know what trend growth is, then I worry that even on a medium-term basis, you know, once you've looked through short-term shocks, then your medium-term forecasts aren't going to be incredibly useful. And that just makes the task of policymakers very, very difficult. I mean, you're almost, to an extent, always flying blind.
In a way, you're describing a model of the economy there that sets up the answer via the assumption, and the assumption is returning to trend growth. So the critical driving variable behind these kinds of macro models to which this thought process applies is that assumption about trend growth, which might, to the general listener, sound very esoteric and a bit academic, but in fact, was absolutely critical in terms of Rishi Sunak's budget yesterday, in terms of the forward-looking assumptions, which particularly interested me. We can talk about all the headline measures, but they've been done to death in the press in the ensuing 24, 48 hours. The outlook for trend growth in the UK economy in Sunak's budget yesterday, the assumption in the models, or the assumption in the documents, were pretty bleak, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. So, you know, in the long run, trend growth is really a productivity story. And, you know, Britain, yeah, but the entire world has had a bit of a productivity problem in terms of productivity growth since 2008 and the financial crisis. It's been particularly acute in Britain in that, you know, we used to, you know, before 2008, we sort of assumed that productivity would grow at about 2.5% a year, something like that. That was the trend. But it's been nothing like that for, you know, the last 15 years, under 1% annually. And, you know, the difference between 2.5% and below 1% might not be very much in any individual year. But over the course of a decade and a half, it becomes a really big undershoot in how your economy is performing. And you look at sort of the medium term forecasts in the budget documents yesterday. And, you know, once you get through this fast growth, as you recover from the pandemic, once that shock's behind you, you know, they think the economy settles into a growth pattern of about 1.5% a year, which, you know, is just weaker than Britain has experienced in the long term for a good 4 or 5 decades. And that was with, you know, and that's really a productivity story. And even that assumes productivity picks up from where it was just before the pandemic. The Office of Budget Responsibility that do the government's forecasts, they publish an excellent chart. You know, they mark their homework and they mark it well. You know, they've been doing these forecasts since 2010, and pretty much every year since 2010, their forecast has been productivity growth picks up in 2 years' time, and that's where we are again. You know, it's yet to happen. Maybe this time is different, to use those dangerous words. But even that really pessimistic 1.5% assumes an improvement which may not come through.
One of the things that sort of got buried within it, it's attracted a little bit of attention, is that not just the forecasts for the economy were interesting, but the estimates of the current state of the economy, because the OBR, this official body that is responsible for the forecasts, froze its forecasts a good while ago. And there's been some data since it froze its forecasts that suggests the economy already is in a bit of a better state. So when Sunak stands up this time next year, he may also have that little bit more wiggle room that better state of the economy has given him. But that, on the basis of those longer term assumptions, is about as best he can hope for. Because one of the things that the political scientist rather than the economist might suspect is that those gloomy assumptions will in fact turn out to be too pessimistic, and that he'll be able to do, that this really was part one of maybe a three-part budget going into the next general election. And maybe it's only a two-part thing, who knows. But the next phase, if yesterday's budget was all about expenditure increases, the next big pre-election bit of the budget will be about tax cuts. But he will need those growth assumptions to have proven to have been pessimistic to pull that rabbit out of a hat, I would assume. Is that right?
He's got a bit of wiggle room at the moment. So he set himself his two fiscal targets. On a three-year basis, he wants the current budget to be balanced. That is, day-to-day government spending should be paid for by taxation. Government will only borrow to invest. And he wants debt to GDP to be falling within 3 years. Now, on the current budget, on the numbers that, you know, the plans yesterday were based on, he's got room for about 1% of GDP of extra spending or tax cuts in 2024, 2025. So he could, on these numbers, go into a general election pledging some sort of tax cut. But yeah, the implicit bet from the Chancellor, I think, is that once the OBR starts using the latest vintage, as they say, the post-revision GDP data that weren't in there, forecasts, then the picture will look a bit better. He will have even more wiggle room. So yeah, I mean, you know, he's doing what chancellors are wont to do, which is, you know, keeping an eye on a political cycle as well as the business cycle, giving himself space for some pre-election and post-election giveaways in 2023 or 2024.
There was a marvelous cartoon in the Times this morning of Rishi Sunak morphing into Gordon Brown. You should take a look at it. Do you agree with the characterization of the budget that it was a budget that a Labour Chancellor would have loved to have given?
In many ways, yeah. But I think I think on the spending side, it was very like Gordon Brown. On the deficit side, though, it was closer to George Osborne. So, you know, for all of the talk of sort of largesse in the budget yesterday, we're still looking at a very sort of rapid closing of the government deficit. The government's deficit. And I think what you get is, if you add Gordon Brown's approach to spending to George Osborne's approach to closing the deficit, what you get is very high taxes. And that's what we've got. You know, the tax burden as a percentage of GDP is going to be the highest since the early 1950s. And it was, you know, it was quite an amazing speech in that the Chancellor spoke for 45 minutes announcing sort of big spending programs, big tax rises. And then at the end, there was this sort of amazing pivot when he did 2 minutes on, I believe in low taxes, I don't like raising taxes, my moral mission is to reduce taxes, which was really hard to square with everything he'd said for the 45 minutes beforehand.
What do you think that says about the state of British politics today, which is that the Conservative Party, which traditionally, and I know this empirically isn't always true, but likes to portray the narrative that it likes to spin about itself is that it is the party of fiscal conservatism. It is the party of lower taxes, smaller government. Clearly, this budget was about higher taxes and most definitely bigger government. It's quite a transformation. And what is it about the British political system that allows them to get away with it with relative ease, this chameleon-like shape-shifting?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very interesting question. I think, this was more of a Boris Johnson budget than a Rishi Sunak budget. I think it's fair to say, certainly on the spending side. And because Rishi Sunak does worry about deficits, if Johnson wanted all of that spending, it was going to be paid for with taxes. And, you know, lots of Conservative backbenchers are not in the best of moods. You know, they thought that Brexit was going to take Britain to this sort of, you know, Singapore on Thames, global Britain, deregulatory, cutting taxes. And actually what's happening is after Brexit, Britain appears to be moving to a more sort of European social model of bigger state, higher taxes. I think what's interesting for the Conservative Party is, you know, it's traditionally been sort of the party of business, the party of low taxes, the party of, you know, slightly more prosperous working people and the better off members of the working class and, you know, cutting their taxes. But, you know, the basis of the Boris Johnson electoral coalition that won in 2019 that he wants to keep together for the early 2020s is fundamentally older people. The single biggest determinant of voting in Britain at the moment is it's not class, it's not education, it's none of those things, it's age. And I think you're now seeing this sort of problem for the Conservative Party that, you know, for their aging demographics that vote for them, spending more money on the NHS, spending more money on social care, all of this sort of stuff is very popular. So they've got a big part of their coalition pushing them towards more spending. And they've sort of ran out of room at the moment to do their traditional tax cuts. And I think that's going to be sort of the tension throughout the 2020s of, you know, for a lot, you know, it makes sense from a sort of electoral point of view to be spending a lot more money on the NHS, to be doing all of this stuff on social care, to be raising corporation tax and national insurance contributions to do that. But a lot of their sort of more ideological backbenchers and supporters are deeply uncomfortable with this approach. And I think that really will be one of the big tensions that emerges over the next 2 or 3 years of this British Parliament.
Yeah, that demographic thing fascinates me because I happened, by a bizarre set of circumstances, to be watching a football game in a pub the other night with a bunch of university undergraduates. I was triple the average age of everybody else in the pub. And one of the things I noticed in talking to them and listening to them and asking them about their banter was that clearly an insult of the day, the insult du jour, is actually to call somebody a Tory, which I've never heard before. And it apparently is the ultimate insult for that particular demographic, or at least for that group of kids in a pub anyway, which speaks to your point more generally, if it is a general truism. One of the things that was contained in the budget yesterday was, of course, an inflation forecast. And there appeared to be, depending on which document you read and who you're listening to, whether it was 4 point something or 5 point something. But that we're clearly in a world where inflation in the UK, at least, if not everywhere else, is heading upwards. And the new chief economist of the Bank of England recently worried that inflation was going to hit 5%. Inflation in the United States is at 5 point something%. And as the Chancellor said yesterday about inflation in particular and supply shortages generally, there are global factors driving this global rise in inflation. And he was quite right to say that. There are, of course, in the UK, particular Brexit influences on the supply chain and therefore part of the inflation issue. So it is partly homegrown, but it is mostly, I think most of us would accept, global. What do you think of this transitory versus it's going to be a real problem debate?
I still lean towards this being transitory, but, you know, transitory, just because something is transitory doesn't mean it is short-lived. I mean, I could easily imagine sort of this higher than we've had inflation in the past lasting another 18 to 24 months. I mean, I don't think there's been a structural change, but I mean, you know, I think on one level, what's happened is really quite straightforward. The global demand has recovered from the pandemic much faster than global supply has been able to. And not just that, but global demand has shifted. if you look at consumer behavior in Britain, in Europe, in North America, you know, the typical advanced economy consumer over the past 18 months has eaten out and gone to the pub a lot less and bought a lot more from Amazon than they did in 2019, seen this huge shift away from consumer spending on services towards consumer spending on goods. So you've got, not only has global demand recovered, but global demand for goods has recovered very fast. Supply hasn't. So you're seeing all of these sorts of bottlenecks and stoppages. Yeah, that's pushing up prices. Now, what's interesting is what's happening in... Now, for this to be more than transitory, I mean, you've also got the energy price story, but again, that's a sort of temporary imbalance. But for this to be more than transitory, I think you need to see this sort of filter through in sort of second round effects of much higher, sustained higher wage growth, which would obviously put up costs for firms.
We're seeing that in the United States a bit, aren't we?
We're seeing some of it in the United States. We're seeing a bit in Britain. We're seeing bits in parts of Europe. I mean, still in most of the world, I think it is a sector story rather than a general story. I think it's particular, you know, certain sectors are really struggling to hire workers because after the pandemic, their workers left those sectors and either got jobs elsewhere or don't want to return to them, and they're having to put up wages to attract workers. Whether that will continue once they have staffed back up or not, I think, is the big question. I mean, so you sort of step back. Has there been a material change in the bargaining power of workers relative to firms? I mean, there's certainly been a temporary one because labor is less abundant than it was before the pandemic. And that's, you know, partially migration is down around the world. Partially, it's that lots of older people seem to have reassessed over the past 18 months and brought forward their retirements. A lot of people in their 60s who were working seem to have dropped out of the labor force in the advanced economies over the last year. So you've got fewer older workers, you've got less migration, you've got sort of a geographic mismatch in that, you know, where the demand for jobs are is not necessarily where the workers are. You know, there is less demand for city centre hospitality staff than there was, more demand in suburbs and smaller towns, and the workers who were working in these places are still in the city centres, it seems. And you've got this sort of shifting composition of the economy. You've got logistics firms desperate to hire, all of that sort of stuff. But is it a structural change in bargaining power? I think that's the question.
If it is, presumably, for those of us that are concerned about inequality, we would welcome it if it was. I mean, would that be right?
No, I think that is true. I mean, look, so sort of step back a second, right? I mean, you know, think of the counterfactual in that in 2020 and early 2021, central banks are much more hawkish. Finance ministries provide much less support to their economies. We don't get that extraordinary policy response we had in 2020, 2021 to the pandemic and the lockdowns and the shutdowns and all of that. Then the economy looks very different today. You know, growth is much lower, unemployment is much higher, and we don't have the inflation problem. You know, to one extent, I think, you know, the shortages problems we're having now and the inflation problem we're having now are almost nice problems to have compared to the alternative.
I personally know a lot of people that would welcome a bit of wage inflation. It strikes me that where this is, as with so many things in economic, if not political life, a lot of this is focused on the United States, where inflation, as I mentioned earlier on, already is over 5%. And the central bank there has already admitted that it's far less transitory than they originally thought, at least publicly. And we discussed on the last podcast that you and I did, Duncan, that this amazing phenomena, which is scarring, post-pandemic scarring. In one of the big features of the UK budget yesterday was that post-pandemic scarring was reduced from 3% of GDP to 2% of GDP, but it still had a minus sign in front of it. Now, as a result of the policies that accompanied the pandemic, the United States post-pandemic scarring, according to official forecasts by the IMF, is going to have a positive sign in front of it. It's the only economy in the world that I've found that will have it. It doesn't make up for the negative scarring that they think is occurring everywhere else. So the world GDP is still less than it would otherwise be. So this inflation problem, you can understand in a way, depending on your theory of inflation, going back all the way to our first question. But if it is about demand versus supply, if you like, and or whatever, you know, whether it's Phillips curve wage style inflation or monetary based inflation, or maybe a bit of both, demand being generated in the United States well in excess of what it would otherwise have been, thanks to all of the stimulus, you can understand why they've got the inflation problem that they've got. And it strikes me that we're reducing our scarring estimates elsewhere. I just mentioned the UK are doing it, and that process may have a bit further to go. We think that -2, I think, could easily become -1 quite quickly on the basis of what we know about the UK economy. So it's beginning to feel to me, looking at that United States thing and the way things are going in the UK, that this inflation problem that we've got. And going back to our question about what is our theory of inflation, if you'd ask me what is my theory of inflation, it looks like we just might have the beginnings of a hypothesis that we've overstimulated our economies a wee bit, certainly in the United States. And that in a way, it's a relatively simple explanation alongside all of those sectoral shifts. I think that shift in consumption thing that you mentioned there is also particularly interesting. And one of the things that I conclude from all of that, and I suppose this is Chris Johns' general theory of inflation, is that this is going to last a bit longer than we thought as a result of all of the stimulus.
It may well do. I mean, I think one way to think about this from a sort of central bank point of view, so, you know, if you're the Bank of England or the ECB or US Federal Reserve at the moment, and you're looking at this inflation, and you'll decide, you know, you're trying to weigh up, is it transitory or not? I mean, you know, essentially, do we as the central bank need to take action to raise interest rates or cut back on QE or whatever it is to dampen down demand, is sort of the balance of risks on that. Central banks do know how to deal with higher inflation. It's painful. You know, it involves raising interest rates, making money more expensive, slowing down demand, possibly increasing unemployment, slowing wage growth, but they know how to do it. And I think the fact that whereas what they don't really know how to deal with is sort of very sluggish demand. You know, you look at the experience of Japan or the Eurozone over the last decade, central banks find themselves with not a huge amount they can do. And I think because they know how to bring down inflation, I think they can let it run longer. The balance of risks is, okay, we're not sure if this is transitory or not. Let's give it another 6 or 8 months. And if it's still going on, that's when we act. Because we know what to do. Whereas the risk is you think something is not transitory, you act now by tightening policy. And if you've made a mistake, it's very hard to reverse that mistake. I'm thinking of the ECB in 2011 under Jean-Claude Trichet, when they hiked interest rates into what turned out to be a temporary period of higher inflation. I mean, if you look back over the last 20 years, sort of, you know, the good calls and the bad calls in monetary policy, I think that ECB rate hike in 2011, you know, scores very highly on the bad decisions.
The policy list. Mistake for which nobody has ever been held accountable, of course. Accountability in central banking. Mm. One of the things that worries me is that in that thesis that you've just posited is that we ascribe too much skill and ability to central bankers to calibrate this inflation problem. Because our belief in the effectiveness of central bank monetary policy is based on our experiences really over the last 40 years since the Paul Volcker era of the early 1980s, in which through interest rates, he crushed the inflation problem that had been created in the United States during the 1970s with a blumming big recession, a double dip recession actually, in the early 1980s. And then the next 40 years of disinflation happened. Which my own personal view is that central bankers deserve some credit, but not all of it for. I think they got lucky as well. I think the China shock had a huge influence on global inflation during that period. But the sense that central banks could quickly sit on inflation with a tweak to interest rates might prove to be not quite how things turn out, that we might be surprised by just how difficult a relatively small inflation problem is to cure. But, you know, we, as you rightly said, this thing isn't symmetrical. They couldn't create inflation when they wanted to with tweaks to interest rates. Japan still can't do it. I think that there's lots of non-linearities, if you want to use mathematical terms here, about pulling bricks with a piece of elastic. Eventually, the brick will hit you in the piece, smack you in the face if you pull on it too hard, and vice versa. So I worry that we won't be able to just say, okay, inflation's a bit higher than we thought it was. We'll whack interest rates up by 50 to 100 basis points. Job done. I don't think, I personally, my own theory of inflation, for what it's worth, is that that might prove to be a wee bit more problematic. Because I do think that other things have to happen to allow that sensible calibration. And I think the way in which, going back to our discussions about the UK and other countries' budgets, fiscal policy is going to be a very important actor on this stage. This isn't just about central banks. And it's going to be much more complicated, I think, than perhaps we hope it's going to be. So what's Duncan Weldon's general theory of inflation?
I think I agree with you on the story of the last 30 or 40 years that, yes, central banks got better at their job. They had a better understanding of their tools. They were more credible. They deserve some credit for the lower and more stable inflation of the 2000s and the 1990s compared to the 70s or the 60s or the 1980s. But I agree with you that they don't deserve all of the credit. There was a structural transformation happening in the economy at the same time, whether that was the China shock, the end of the Cold War, sort of this era of hyper-globalization and more international supply chains in the 90s and 2000s. You know, the pool of workers available to advanced economy firms essentially doubled in two decades after 1990. That's a huge disinflationary shock. And labor in the West, you know, the advanced economies, whatever the preferred term is nowadays, was in a very different place. You had more flexible labor markets, more liberal labor markets, much weaker trade unions, much lower trade union coverage. And I think, you know, structurally more flexible labor markets and lower labor bargaining power, plus globalization, that's an awful lot of your story of deflation over the last 20, 30 years. You know, I think central banks deserve some credit, but changes in the real economy matter as well. And that's what gives me reasonable, I'm never very confident on a forecast, but gives me reasonable confidence that this in 24 months time, I'll give myself an opt-out, 24 months time, that inflation will be lower. Because I don't think that structural transformation in the economy has been reversed by the pandemic. You know, we're still going to have global supply chains, maybe slightly less so, but still very global compared to the 1970s. I don't think we're going to see a sudden revival in trade union power anywhere in the advanced economies. So I think even if central bankers do muck it up a bit, you know, I think that structural transformation is still there. You know, people keep talking about the 1970s. You know, I mean, I don't think we're going to get anything like the 1970s. You know, even if inflation keeps rising in the US from above 5% to 6 or 7 or 8%, you know, they're still the kind of numbers that policymakers would have killed for in the late 1970s.
Absolutely. I can remember inflation being about 25% in the UK. I'm that old. And I can also remember, associated with that, paying a mortgage that later on, in the 1980s, I think, that was a significant portion of my monthly income as a result. So I agree, we're not going back to that. Duncan, as always, that's been a fabulous conversation. At least I enjoyed it thoroughly. A big thank you for making the time to come on the other hand today. And hopefully we'll get you on again sometime soon. All the best with your own Substack publication. Just finally, are the sales of the book going well?
Yes, they are. I mean, the thing about publishing is nobody ever tells you what's good. So you never quite know what the benchmark is. But I'm we're happy. It's now on its third print run.
Great. Oh, wow. That must be a sign of success. So that's where I'll conclude. Another plug for Duncan's book and another big thank you for coming onto the other hand. Thanks a lot, Duncan.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Chris Johns and Jim Power on The Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please sign up to our Substack account, www.cjpeconomics.substack.com. you can download our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and other good podcast platforms.